Did that do what you needed?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
All right.
Hi, I'm here with John Sather of Swaback Architects and Planners in Scottsdale, Arizona. John is partners with Vern Swaback, and I interviewed him in another podcast a few years ago. And so I'm here to speak with John about his career. What are your first recollections of experiencing architecture?
Well, thank you for having me, Michelle. You know, it's really interesting. I grew up in Minneapolis, you know, pretty conventional suburb that was probably built after World War II. So you might think I grew up in a tract home. And when I ultimately went to college, so you would say that I really had no exposure to great architecture. I didn't live in New York City or Paris or Madrid. And so it wasn't until I was in college and I visited some of my high school friends who had gone to a different university. And I went to a building by Marcel Breuer. Mm-hmm. And it was a brutalist building. It's at the St. John's University in Minnesota. And it's a monastery. And as I went through this building, I think this is true of most architects going in and the general public, but architects are probably much more aware of it. You began to feel what architecture does to you. Mm-hmm. And so something just began to stay within me about that building. And, you know, you might say I was kind of bereft of other great architecture. And then one time I came from a large family. After that experience, I was having dinner with one of my brothers who was in college. And he started talking about this architect named Wright who had designed, he had learned about this mile-high building. And I was still young. I was in early days of college, and my ears just kind of perked up, and I thought it was rather interesting. And so I began to just sense, I think, and a lot of this is, me looking back. Mm-hmm. I began to become curious about architecture. It wasn't something that, you know, I was aware of at all times, but it began to kind of play. And then at one point in time, I was at the University of Minnesota, and I was in an art class, which was really a general curriculum kind of art class. And the professor, maybe midway through the year, had a series of days where he focused on Frank Lloyd Wright. And he was a great Frank Lloyd Wright aficionado, you might say, and so he exposed us to the work of Frank Lloyd Wright. And so in those 3 days, and particularly in the last day, something just turned on in me. I often at times think it, you know, I believe architects who are truly devoted to the profession feel as if they have a calling, mm-hmm. not a job. Mm-hmm. And something just began to burn within me. And I had to know more and more and more. But it was probably at that time, and maybe it was this exposure by this professor to Wright, but I just went on this in-depth study of personal study of architecture and looking into Wright. And early on in that study, and it triggered to me that he had started talking about this place that Wright had lived. And this group of people that he had around him. And so I began to study more and ultimately learned more about the Frank Lloyd Wright fellowship, the Franklin Wright School of Architecture, and all of it just began to kind of stitch together in my brain, and it became kind of this great passion for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, all I was doing was looking at architecture books. I wasn't drawing. My father wasn't an architect. He was a construction worker.
So he was a construction worker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so I had that exposure.
Mm-hmm.
I boldly, at that point, wrote a letter to Mrs. Franklin Wright.
Uh-huh.
And said that I wanted to become a student at the school.
What was your major at the University of Minnesota?
So it was French.
Oh, really?
And calculus.
Oh, wow.
And I was incredibly good at high levels of math.
Mm-hmm.
But I had no idea what I would ever do with it. And I kept kind of quizzing professors about, I would solve this stuff in a second. And I could sit on blackboards and fill the whole thing up with equations and understand what it really meant. But I didn't understand what I was going to do. Was I going to go and build something with this? Was I going to teach? What was I going to do? So
yeah.
I just got disillusioned with it. And so it quickly, this was like something that, okay, I really would love to do this. I'd love looking at all this. And mm-hmm. so I began getting deeper and deeper into this. Mm-hmm. And one day I received a telegram, not an email, a telegram from Olga Vanna Lloyd Wright saying that she would like me to visit her at Taliesin West to be interviewed as a student.
Mm-hmm.
So I journeyed to Arizona in the summer. Now, it was rare that they would have been here in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Normally, the fellowship, as it was known, would have been in its Wisconsin home of Taliesin. But they were here that year because the Arizona Biltmore Hotel had been gutted by fire. And
okay.
They had been hired to totally restore the hotel within a 90-day period. So I
wow.
came here in the heat of August, having never been in Arizona, never been on an airplane, and got a taxi cab driver to drop me off at the main gate at Taliesin West, which in those days was about 3/4 of a mile from the building. So in 110 degree weather, wearing an inappropriately weighted sport coat, I walked up this road. And shortly a little car comes, a Volkswagen and a woman, and she stops and said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Well, I'm here to have an appointment with Mrs. Franklin Wright." And she said, "Hop in." So it was a woman named Cornelia Brierley. Cornelia Brierley was Frank Lloyd Wright's first female apprentice.
Okay.
And she was ultimately became one of my teachers. And mm-hmm. so as the day progressed, I met Mrs. Wright in the Grand Taliesin West living room and had a several-hour interview with her. And she said, "I think you'll do fine here."
Mm-hmm.
So 6 months later, I came back as a student and lived in a tent in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my long answer to a short question about my early exposure to architecture.
That's pretty
so,
fascinating.
So that day, yeah, you might say, began the next part of my journey. That was
yes.
my journey to begin my lifelong journey.
Yes, definitely. What are three classic buildings that you like and why?
You know,
and they're not classical. They're
okay,
classic.
So yeah. Certainly not classical.
Yeah, yeah.
So because of my background, it would be obvious that one would be Taliesin West. So
mm-hmm.
let me wax on that a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Taliesin West is an experimental campus of buildings. It is dynamic from mm-hmm. the first days that Wright started the campus. It has changed often. And in my days there as a student, I continued to build and make change to it. It is truly one of the finest statements of what would be, Wright's philosophy of organic architecture. Mm-hmm. It is of the place, it is of the earth. It was built of the materials of the site.
Mm-hmm.
So much like the adobes of the prehistoric times here, prehistory times, Wright and the students would go out into the desert and collect the rocks. They would go into the washes and collect the sand to make the cement that we would make the buildings with. And so it grew and it changed and it was always dynamic. But it was a response to the region, to the climate, to the starkness, to the beauty of the Sonoran Desert. The Sonoran Desert is the most diverse desert in the world. It is, by most estimations, the most beautiful desert in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a composition of structures that does not compete but sits quietly with the desert. It has a phenomenal backdrop of mountains and a phenomenal view of the valley below. And so as an inhabitant, a resident mm-hmm. of Taliesin West, you know it well, you know it as your home. So you know it in ways much different than if you if I had picked a church or an office building or a museum as an answer to your question. And so the blurring of the indoor and outdoor aspects of it is just astounding because it is a composition of buildings that is really not for year-round use. It was always contemplated to be maybe 6 to 8 months of occupancy.
Mm-hmm.
So it is it's somewhat ill-suited for the harshness of the harsh summers of Arizona. But it's a celebration of the desert in all the reasons that people love to come to the desert, the mm-hmm. great winters that we have here, et cetera. So the interesting aspects of it is it doesn't respond a lot to those aspects we as architects spend so much time of our life in studying now of sustainability and the thermodynamics of buildings, et cetera. It's bold and simple.
Mm-hmm.
And so most of the buildings are somewhat uninsulated, but they're insulated in ways that that buildings have always been insulated in the past by mass. So the walls are 3 and 4 feet thick. The orientation of the buildings, some of which you might be critical of as it relates to things like western exposure to the sun, et cetera. So Wright was never perfect, and so it was his research lab. So he had grown up in Wisconsin, and he moved to the desert. And so, like all of us going to other parts of the world to practice, even though Wright was a genius, that doesn't mean you know everything about everything. So there are aspects of Taliesin West that aren't perfect, that probably might be changed. But it is a timeless collection of buildings. It is not about any kind of fads of the day, and it is not really about some extraordinary statement by a soloist genius architect. It is a space about the space within to be lived. So even though one can look at Taliesin West and think of the and just have incredible viewpoints of the composition, that's really meaningless to the real purpose, which is what it is like to dwell and inhabit these main structures. This what started out, quite frankly, is a camp.
Mm-hmm.
in the desert. Yeah. And so in the early days, it was canvas roofed. Even in my time, it was canvas. I, in the big understanding of Taliesin West, had a tent, a sheep herder's tent that I lived in canvas when I was first a student, and then ultimately another, what you might construe as a very open pavilion that overlooked the whole desert. So all these different pieces that make up Taliesin West really also responded to community. So the moving part of Taliesin West is not only the structures, it's how people, how a unrelated group, other than related for the purpose of architecture, live together in communal type atmosphere, but how this whole group lived together. And it's very interesting in the compression of that. I recently was in Turkey and was at the ancient city of Ephesus. And if you look at a collection of buildings, basically a city that was built 1,000 years BC, and the phenomenal integration of how community lived together, those aspects are in Taliesin West, just like they're in maybe successors to right, Paolo Saleri building Arcosanti. Mm-hmm. These are places that are incredibly integrated and all about community. And so it really, it's classic in its sense that it is, it's on a World Heritage Site now. It will be studied for all of time. It's still dynamic, but not as dynamic as it was when the school and the foundation inhabited it differently than it does now.
Yeah. Yeah. I always really like going there because, I am always discovering something new. I mean, every time I've gone there several times, I still notice a detail or some type, and there's the water elements that are there and kind of how it all works together. And, of course the views of the sunsets are always amazing. And,
but if you look at it also from the aspect of what went on there, there was the lifestyle within, quite frankly, a fairly small footprint working. So there was a great drafting room where Frank Lloyd Wright first and his apprentices and students afterwards produced great buildings around the world. Short distance from that was a performing arts center. Short distance from that is a great kind of communal living room where very formal events occurred. Short distance from that are gardens that supply the food that went into the kitchen that this communal organization would all share in the cooking. Mm-hmm. Yet there was privacy, so the individual individuals who inhabited Taliesin, whether they be single or family oriented, all had dwellings within it that all worked together. All of that also was, to some degree, open to the public in that people have always visited Taliesin out of curiosity throughout all the years. And so you had, it wasn't a closed cloister, it wasn't a monastery, but it was, it was not just wide open to the public, but the public certainly came for certain events. So it to me, it is one of the great pieces of architecture of the world. But more than anything, it teaches you about the desert. In my own personal experience of living in a tent and working there, etc., it has informed my work. I was there as a student I left there 45 years ago. So all the things that it taught me, I still, I don't slavishly, the work of our firm, you wouldn't look at it and say, oh, that all looks like Frank Lloyd Wright. It all has and demonstrates principles of Wright's beliefs of organic architecture.
Mm-hmm.
The desert aspects of Taliesin West have certainly consistently informed my work in the projects we do in the Sonoran Desert.
Yeah, yeah.
So that would be one classic building. Mm-hmm. Another would be its almost antithesis, which is Taliesin in Wisconsin. So uh-huh. Taliesin, Wisconsin was the counterpoint to our life at Taliesin under the fellowship. So we would live in the desert for approximately 8 months of the year. And then we would migrate, journey to a small farming community in Wisconsin, Spring Green, a beautiful valley in what's known as the driftless area of Wisconsin. It has the Wisconsin River flowing through it. And Wright's estate of Taliesin, which was his home, that was ancestral in its background. He moved there and began building his first home well before he had started the foundation of the fellowship or the school, but shortly after he had left working for Adler and Sullivan, Louis Sullivan, mm-hmm. And began taking over family property. He had previously built a school there for his aunts that was known as the Hillside Home School. It was thought to be the first co-ed boarding school in the country. And they had gifted him the land, and so he had begun to build what was known as Taliesin One.
Mm-hmm.
And throughout the great stories of Taliesin, there had been fires and murders and rebuildings and great stories of Wright's life there. But as I came there also as a student, so we would have lived there in the summers, there were multiple parts of what is roughly 800 acres, I think, at the time. So where the main estate of Taliesin, there was what was known as Hillside, which was the continuation of the Hillside Home School, which was where the great drafting room of Wisconsin was.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was a working farm, so there was what is known as Midway Farm, which is kind of halfway between the main Taliesin estate and Hillside. And Romeo and Juliet, which is one of the most striking windmills that one may ever see in their life. And some of the older structures that were there, Tanny Dairy, which was a home that had been there that he had built for some relatives before he started building Taliesin. So all of that began to be woven together originally as Wright's personal home. And then as he started the school and the students came, more apprentices came. And then as his life went on and his commissions expanded, then it became a great tradition once Taliesin West was formed to migrate between the two properties.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was a great difference between Taliesin and Taliesin West. They look completely different.
Yeah.
The Taliesin is much more of Wright's Midwestern work. Many of the low-slung roofs and the great overhangs and the stonework, the woodwork, the very sculptural interior forms, and the fact that the property was really built to be much more year-round, so it was much more enclosed than Taliesin West was. So it was a complete different response to the climate. But once again, it held the principles of organic architecture in that the stonework, the sandstone, limestones were were quarried just down the road, and the oak trees that made the major drafting room were trees that were cut from the property and milled there and used and made into these very incredible truss forms that span the width of the drafting room, with the daylight coming through them that has the feeling almost of an abstract forest with the sun filtering through. So even though it was a completely different composition in a completely different climate, it still had the very obvious forms of organic architecture and its principles throughout.
It's sustainable, right?
Very
definitely,
and obviously, when Wright built both of these, the word sustainable was not in everyone's lips now.
Mm-hmm.
But what was so interesting and so curious about its, both Taliesin and Taliesin West, about its timelessness is that in today's world of, let's call both of these somewhat residential architecture, because people actually live there. People now seem to be more interested in the type of faucets and the type of tile they pick than the whole composition of their dwelling and what those spaces do to form their life.
Yeah.
And so when you go to Taliesin or Taliesin West, you may see, old fixtures or faucets or light switches or, what might look like dated tile or something. It's all meaningless because you look past it all, because the great forms of stone
or the plans.
They are the strength of the architecture, mm-hmm. not the fact that, isn't that a beautiful Cheryl Wagner sink or something? and quite frankly, that is part of the troubling part of architecture now.
Yes. Yeah.
So I would say those are two very classic buildings. And if you've asked me to name three, it's always, you can never stop with two as an architect, and you could go on. But I will tell you, and it's just because of a recent trip that I had been in Turkey, is visiting the city of Ephesus. It probably fulfills the more classical, as opposed to classic, form of architecture, and it's more of a ruin than it is a current building. But what is so stunning is, after you walk through it and you really begin to study it, you think about, first off, you think when this actually was built originally, and you think of the incredible integration of apartments, of amphitheaters, of shops, of walkways, of everything from communal bathrooms to all the things that made up this town, and where people could bring carts and where they would be naturally stopped by steps for a public walkway.
Mm-hmm.
It's stunning that kind of thinking went into structures 1,000 years before Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if you extract that and bring that to modern day, you begin to think that, some of these, very modern expressions of that may be Silicon Valley campuses or things like that where people think, oh, that's a new idea, it's very integrated. and you just
like
kind of have to laugh
use,
and go,
right? Mixed use.
Yeah,
it's
yeah, like yeah. What happened here? I mean, this was so highly sophisticated so many years ago, and it's now taken us thousands of years to get back to this.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, it's just stunning. And so, there is a lot to be learned from classical architecture, of looking past to look to the future,
mm-hmm.
As opposed to looking to the past to copy the past,
yes.
or ignoring the past.
Yes.
And so, those are three buildings that have meant a lot in my life, that has informed my work, that caused me great reflection. And buildings, and these three examples were, you know, they're not like a singular building like a library or house. But they give you great pause as you think about your work and what you've learned from them. And so they're buildings that, you know, have certainly been timeless, but they've taught you things. So.
So what do you like about being an architect?
Being an architect is challenging. I have often told my clients that, I don't want to sound this odd, but I truly believe that architecture is a calling if you're really meant to be in the practice. I have a strong belief there are too many architects in the world. I think there's a whole lot of architects who are just producing trash and buildings that should never have been built. But to those of us, and there's certainly a lot of those who are incredibly devoted to the profession and are creating great work, it is just something that gives you life. It is obviously not a job for me. I truly believe this is something I was called to do. And so I wake up every day excited, challenged. I learned from Franklin Wright that I believe this is not a profession you stop. I think I will be doing this till the day I die. Wright practiced this till he was in his 90s. And what's stunning is the work that he did in the later part of his life after 75.
Yeah.
He was 75 when he came to the desert to build Taliesin West. Just think about that. And so
he had never... So he first came at 75.
Well, he had actually come before.
Uh-huh. For the Biltmore.
No.
To look at the Biltmore. No,
well,
no.
The Biltmore was one. Mm-hmm. So he had come in the late 20s, 30s to do the Biltmore. Then he had been called here by a client named Chandler, which one of our suburbs is named after, to design a resort for the wealthy. And this was not the Biltmore, this was another one.
Uh-huh.
And so for that, he began to create what was called Okatia.
Mm-hmm.
So Okatia was a tent camp that he built in southern, what we think of South Phoenix now.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a collection of canvas structures meant to house him for a winter. This is prior to him starting the fellowship even, so it would have been in the late 20s, early 30s. And he moved here and made this tent camp, put down great Indian rugs, had a concert grand piano in it, had his drafting room, and lived in it for a couple of years. And during that period of time, it was then that he located the land that became Taliesin West. And his doctor had advised him that living in Wisconsin, like many people, that wasn't the best move to stay there in the winter. So he used to come here. And at one point, there's a very famous telegram where he sent to his, who were now becoming his apprentices, students, primarily William Wesley Peters, who was his first student apprentice, saying, "I have now found the land, pack up the trucks, bring the cement mixer and shovels, and come to the great Maricopa Mesa," which is what he called Phoenix at the time. And that was the beginning of Taliesin West. So going back to, you know, what do I like about architecture? It's... It's a very fulfilling profession.
Yeah.
It is one that it's daunting. You simply can never learn enough to do what you're being asked to do.
Mm-hmm.
And so in my my life as a student at Taliesin, I truly believed helped me in many, many ways, not just to learn to draw or learn to design, but as living within the School of Architecture and doing everything. So there were no hired help.
Yeah.
So we learned to maintain things. We learned to build things. We learned to cook in the kitchen. All that ultimately informed me because I can now speak to, okay, this is the best workings of a kitchen because I used to work in a kitchen at Taliesin that put out food for 60 some people.
Yeah.
Or we would run the systems that ran the water or the mechanical systems of it or the theater and the lighting and all of these things or the acoustics in the auditorium. All those things ultimately Wright had the belief of learning by doing. And so those are all things that in my career, it's like a light bulb turns on. You go, yes, I know how to do that because I did this once or whatever. And
yeah.
So it's just immensely exciting to me to wake up every morning and know that I am an architect. There are days that, it's overwhelming. We're a very busy firm.
Yeah.
And so
building department
deadlines,
issues.
Building,
yeah.
complex structures.
Yeah.
It's a profession of compromise.
Yes, you know, definitely.
You can,
yeah.
I've had very few buildings not built.
Mm-hmm.
And so you go through budgets, you go through client, interests and tastes, and it's not, I personally have never experienced things like I keep going back to Wright, but there's a famous, line where, Wright designed a large home for the McCormicks of Chicago, and he unrolled all the drawings from Mrs. McCormick, and she started basically saying, well, I can't have a bedroom like that. It's too small, or the kitchen, this and that. And he finally just said, fine, then you don't need me, and he rolled up his drawings and left. And, that's a very famous house he had designed that is not built.
So he didn't actually do it. They didn't call him back?
No. It's in the history books.
Uh-huh.
You can see the drawings, but there's no McCormick house in Chicago. There's a McCormick name on everything.
Exactly.
But not but, yeah, on a Wright
the
building.
Conventions there, yeah.
So I think, and I often counsel, we're often asked by clients and others, can you talk to my son? He wants to be an architect, or my daughter. And I wish there were more of them who were saying that about their daughters, because we still are a male-dominated profession.
Mm-hmm.
That should not be. But the thing about it is I don't think you can be forced to become an architect. I don't think your parents can encourage you. It has to come within.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to find it. And so it, as I told you in the very beginning, it found me. It was, and that's often people talk about the word calling in kind of a religious term. And, you could say, given the gravity of architecture, that it is of that level. But that's why Wright said, what is your religion? And he said, it's nature with a capital N. And so, if I was called to a profession that had anything to do with religion, I still believe in that that in the world of organic architecture, it all begins with nature. It all begins with the earth. And the earth pretty much tells you what it wants on it, if you're listening. And all that may sound a little bit, philosophical, but it really is what motivates you, what makes you happy as an architect. And, it's certainly a gift that I was given that I'm thankful for every day.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that is what a lot of people miss in architecture, and why some architects aren't fulfilled. It's because the work isn't coming from the site. It's what they're being told to do on the site, and then that's the frustration that some of us experience.
Well, and I once had a conversation with Mrs. Frank Lloyd Wright, and I said, you know, Wright was famously quoted as saying that architecture was a gray-haired man's profession. Well, I certainly have the gray hair. But I asked her what she thought that meant. And she said it means that to be a good architect, you simply have to have immense amount of experiences unless you truly are a genius. And she believed he was a genius. Mm-hmm. So she treated him in that realm, and she treated others as if, I'm not a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
So if you want to be an architect, you better experience everything in life you can, because it will add to what you're doing. So, in my life of architecture, I'm just consumed with it every way, shape, or form 24 hours a day. So my life is all about putting myself in experiences, doing worldwide travel, studying, looking, observing, and all of that really does add to your quality as an architect, and your qualifications to be
architect. And I think, like, the spatial knowledge.
And unless you give it all, unless you really give your life over to architecture, you'll never get there. Because there are, there have been few geniuses of architecture. There's some that might veer upon it, but 99.999% of us aren't that. Yeah. So we have to work hard at getting there.
Yeah.
Some work less hard and are gifted more than perhaps me.
Well, you've got a pretty good start there. What would you like to say about the future of architecture?
Some of the future of architecture scares me. And it's where the future of architecture is evolving from. And so what scared me until the last couple, or last year or even two, is things like Google Images. And although that sounds weird, I believe that an immense amount of buildings are being done by picking and choosing off of Google Images.
Yeah, I think so.
I like
too.
That. I like that. What if we do that? What if we do that? What if?
Yeah.
And the purity of originality is eroding.
Mm-hmm.
And it is just, and it's a tool that clients use for communication. And it's more and more becoming the tool of choice of most young architects. Now, it can be used good and bad. The good side of it is it allows you to experience the world rather quickly just through a two-dimensional photograph without getting on planes and doing the great tour of Europe or whatever, from Paris to Istanbul or whatever. But way too many people are looking at it as something to copy.
Mm-hmm.
And or terms of architecture, like it is informed by this. Meaning, I just wrote an email and I said, somebody sent me an email that said this is informed by that. And I said, why don't you just say you stole another architect's work? Be candid. Because that's what you did. And so that scares me as it relates to that. The other thing that scares me is AI.
Yeah.
And, we are, as a firm, struggling with, as businesses across the world, what does this mean to us? And when you read in the profession that some very well-known name firms, utilize it as a tool and can produce 30, 50 looks to a building by just simply, going through preferences and that, and all of a sudden now here's 30 options for you to consider, Mr. Client. And they've never drawn a line, or they've used it from their library of past work and have, you know, have it pick and choose as it goes. So where AI goes for architects, mm-hmm. it will mean something very different for many, many different people. I don't know, but what troubles me is that it could end up in the world of, okay, I don't have to think real hard. I don't have to be creative. I don't have to worry about originality because it will do it for me. This is a hard profession. It requires you looking deep in your soul to create something that has never been created before, a one-of-a-kind piece. And not everything has to be one-of-a-kind, but that really is endemic in the profession of originality. And so where that goes, I don't know. I think some of the other things of the future of architecture are being well handled. I think systems and building systems, mechanical systems, structural systems are all kind of progressing as mankind has progressed for the ages, as it continues on. The issues of sustainability and, well, you know, how do we deal with climate change and all of these things? You know, we'll deal with that. I think we'll get better with that, and many, many in the world are helping solve things like that. We live here in a desert, one of the most beautiful deserts in the world, but also, you know, a place that it's not shy about getting to 118 degrees. So the future of architecture, unfortunately, here in the Sonoran Desert, has not really responded well to the desert. And this became very clear to me. I took a trip to Yemen and drove across Yemen with my wife, really to tour the tower houses of Yemen and to go to the famous city of Shabam. Mm-hmm. When we were out deep, we had a driver, an interpreter, a land cruiser, and we were driving through the Hadhramaut desert, and you see sheep herders and things like that, and you see their natural dress and the hats they wear and the things, all to help with natural cooling. Or I have a home in Mexico in a very remote part, and the idea, the true definition of siesta, meaning rest in the day when it is the warmest, is still part of the culture. But here, we're now a culture driven by air conditioning, and your life doesn't adapt to that. So, well, I'm in the middle
of... Which is really difficult, because I do not like air conditioning. Yeah. I mean, like, this is one of the only places. This is one of the only places we're all using.
We're involved in a project that we believe will be one of the most important educational and research centers focused on desert and arid lands in the world. And if you say, well, why would you do that? And you'd say, well, name another place that one can actually go and study about desert and arid lands, yet it is the only landmass that's increasing in the world. Mm-hmm. And so the impetus behind that is teaching people, researching, how should we really live in the desert? And so bringing this all the way back to Wright. Wright came here from Wisconsin and lived, quite frankly, in a, you know, a very beautiful home, but adapted quickly to the desert and began to build forms of structure that responded to it and understood the idea of cross ventilation and shade and shadow and self-shading of buildings and orientation. All those things are endemic in the buildings he built here in the desert. And as now we are a massively growing metropolitan area, and we are driven by developers who build homes quicker than you can think of them, They're all meaningless because they don't respond to anything. They look straight west. They look straight east. They have no overhangs. They, you know, they're poorly insulated.
They're really large.
You know, yeah, they're very small large. Kids yeah. come and live in their first starter home, yet they can't go outside because there's no shade covered areas. So, you know, in that aspect, the future of architecture is dim, but there's the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So I often profess in some areas we work some cities. I work in the city of Sedona, Arizona. I do some work.
Okay.
And I often talk to the city about it, saying that, you know, this city is really just a teenager. So it has growing pains. And if you look at cities on the East Coast that are hundreds of years old, you know, this was settled in 1600 or something. You come here, it was settled in, you know, 1948. So all these things that seem wrong now, it's like a growing child. It's like a gangly teenager. So if you look at it in those aspects and say, okay, well, maybe we need to rethink this whole suburban model of a shopping center and think of it in a much more somewhat urban way. This has now become a town, a city,
yeah.
And yet it still is holding on to these suburban principles. Why? So in those aspects of, you take the negative and look at it in a positive way, and architects, you know, I think by nature have a positive outlook in their life, that these become great opportunities to improve the world. And, you know, if you go back to architecture as a calling, that's really what you're here to do, is improve your time here on Earth.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. So is there anything else that you wanted to say?
I'll close with a little bit of a discussion. I'm a trustee on the board of the School of Architecture formed by Frank Lloyd Wright. Now, mm-hmm. the School of Architecture is no longer... does no longer dwell at Taliesin for a variety of reasons, I really won't go into. But after 90 years, the school is still alive. It's a different format than maybe William Wesley Peters, who was its first student, or my partner Vern Swaback, who came in the late 50s, or I, who came in the 70s. So it evolved. It's 90 years old and continuing on. And I just attended the graduation of, it's still an accredited school of architecture. It is one of the most unique schools of architecture in at least the United States, if not the world. It is still professing the learning by doing. It's more of a master's thesis program than it was, which is really part of its evolution as the profession and the state licensing has occurred. And so they have had changes than the days that I was there. But what is positive about this is that the work of Wright, not I create buildings that look like Wright, it's the work of organic architecture. Still, that flame that Wright started and continued at Taliesin is still growing and still continuing on, and it's an exciting thing. And so even though in this discussion I've dwelled probably too much on Wright, but talked about his buildings and my time there. And what I am trying to do is do my part in being certain that this that was passed on to me, mm-hmm. because I came after Wright, that I keep this this going. It's a school, but it really is a philosophical architectural movement of architecture centered around organic architecture, learning by doing. And going back to one of your other comments, that's a positive thing of architecture. And here, as I run a firm now of 45 people, we hire people from, you know, all the great architectural schools, but few of them, Harvard, whatever, ASU, U of A, these students are not coming out there with the basic knowledge of how to build a building, all of the learning by doing aspects.
Yeah, that preconceived notion.
And so even though this is a small school, it has a very, very important part of the world. And
it's at Arcosanti now, right?
It's at, our home is at Arcosanti. Okay. And we are in the search for our permanent home.
Oh, okay.
And it won't be Arcosanti. That was never the theory, but okay. It's moving on, growing. And what's interesting, as a young student, we used to stare out over the valley from Taliesin West and see the encroaching track tones coming up against this great masterpiece of architecture. Yeah. And we used to laugh and say, what would Wright do? I mean, he would be horrified at this. And we, you know, he'd make it up. He'd say, well, he'd move to Guatemala and build, you know, Taliesin South. But with the school decamping from Taliesin West and moving on, what's exciting about its future is its future. And where ultimately its permanent home will be, but right now its home at Arcosanti is a wonderful existence. Arcosanti is, you know, the beauty of Arizona is it has spawned some of the most experimental architecture in Taliesin West, Cosanti, Arcosanti, you know, than any other place, and you know, I probably believe that has to do with the rawness, the energy that one gains in the desert. So
yeah.
I'll end there.
Yeah. Thank you very much, John.